Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted that we are starting the week with one of our all-time favorite morning show guests, author Michael Schumacher, who hails right here in Kenosha. And so he is able to join us in the studios. And we have been doing this for quite some time. I mean, for probably a quarter of a century, Michael has been a very regular visitor to the morning show, talking about the many books that he has crafted. That being said, I think for all of the times that he has been on the morning show, we have actually never taken the time to talk about his connection with Allen Ginsberg and the many books about Allen Ginsberg that Michael Schumacher has written over the years. His most recent is a volume that Michael Schumacher edited called Allen Ginsberg, South American Journals, January to July 1960. This is quite a fascinating book that really takes us inside the mind and heart and soul of Allen Ginsberg. And so today we're going to be talking not only about this particular book, but also kind of getting an overarching idea of Michael Schumacher's powerful connection with Allen Ginsberg, somebody that he knew very well and somebody who he has written about extensively. Michael Schumacher, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's always a good time.
So I'm looking forward to this very, very much. So this book that has just come out, edited by you, how many books does this make over the course of your whole career? Not just about Allen Ginsberg, but just
period?
In general, or have you lost count?
I think that was my 24th, I think. You know, it's one of those things I got to go back and kind of, but it's my sixth with Allen, and the seventh will be later this year. And I think that will be it.
Very good. Well, it's an amazing legacy all around. And, of course, what you have done with the legacy of Allen Ginsberg specifically is quite extraordinary. So let's begin first on a very personal kind of level.
Sure.
Tell us how you came to actually meet Allen Ginsberg and know him. What is your personal connection with him?
Well, that's a transition. You know, it really is, because I met Allen just doing a magazine article. I was interviewing him for a magazine. But for some reason, there was some kind of a connection. I don't know. It's a hard thing to explain. Because when I was writing, I wrote a biography. Was the first thing I did of Allen, a book called Dharma Lion. And it's a very large book, and I got to know Allen. I spent 8 years working on that book. And so I got to know him, but I was also really, I don't want to say standoffish isn't the word, but, you know, I didn't want to be accused of not being objective about it. So I kept my distance.
Like a professional kind of distance, but which makes sense.
We got to know each other, you know, over the years. And when I was finished working on the biography and it was coming out, things changed in the respect that I could be more myself and he could be more himself or whatever. I think Allen was always himself, frankly, but
he could be more unguarded. He could be more unguarded, maybe?
He was. It was funny because there were certain aspects of his life that were hard for him. For example, his juvenile journals, the ones he kept as a high school and college kid, he refused to let anybody publish. They were edited. They were ready to go. But he was so embarrassed by who he was at that time, it had to be posthumous. He wouldn't have it in his lifetime. And in my case, there were a couple of events that had occurred that were very difficult. He and I differed, for example, about when he got kicked out of Cuba. Well, he goes down to Cuba, you know, he's going to do a literary conference, and he's going to judge a poetry contest and all this. And he goes down there, and this is Castro's Cuba in 1965, early 1965, and he starts firing off on anything and everything. You can't do that. You can't. And I remember when the book came out, he thought I was less than sympathetic. I said, well, Alan, I mean, come on.
You mean he didn't like the way you described that, and you probably described it very right accurately.
He agreed on that. There was another very, very, very difficult period. He couldn't even read that section of the book. He turned it over to another person who I also knew and said, let me know what you think. And she went back to him, and she said it was fair. And that's all I can say. You know, if they aren't questioning the accuracy and they think I'm being fair, okay. We all have our moments. You know, and I'm getting that going through these journals now. I had read them all when I was working on Dharma Lion, but not as closely. There's a connection you get to the material that's kind of hard to describe. If you're actually typing out someone else's words, you know, as opposed to you're doing your own, and you're obviously more connected in the respect that you're writing them all out, you're typing them all out. And, you know, at this point, I've typed, I don't know what, you know, a couple thousand pages of Alan's journals. And so it was, you know, a different kind of experience, a different way of knowing Alan. I wish I'd known the journals as well as I do now when I was interviewing him for Dharma Lion. It's a really strange thing, because Alan was always very good to so-called friends of the family or whatever you want to call it. You know, and when I by that, I mean, I remember one time with him going into the office and he says, I'm going out to dinner. You want to come out? And boy, I would have sold my soul for a tape recorder at that dinner. Larry Rivers, the great painter, was there, and a bunch of poets were there, and some of the Ginsberg people. There were about, I don't know, nine of us there. And the conversation was fast and lively and fun. And that was the bonus that I got, getting to know him. You know, I'm trying to sneak back to the beginning of this whole thing with your question, because it evolved over the years. I think he trusted me. But I also think that, you know, that level of trust took a different dimension, as it were, over time. And when Alan died, I remember this was in 97.
Right.
I got a call from his office saying he's very, very sick and he's not going to live. He's expected, they're giving him 8 to 10 months, and he says he's not going to make it that long. Well, he was right. He lived 1 week. To the day. And I remember them calling to tell me, and they wanted me, said Alan, when he was, they told me that he was sick, said Alan wants to see you, but don't come next week. And I thought, my God. There were things like that kind of gave me the impression that this was really a friendship. He mailed me, and I still have it, on Christmas Day. He was out in Tangiers, and he mailed me a postcard. And it was a really interesting postcard, because he, you know, after wishing me a Merry Christmas, which was interesting because Alan was the Buddhist Jew, he goes, here I am sitting here. I'm in the same building that Jack Kerouac and I were in 1960. And I look back on it, and it was a wonderful period of time. And he's going on in this postcard, you know, and that was special to me. You know, because that he would think of me, of all the people he knows, and I know Alan also, incidentally, in the respect that I certainly wasn't the only person he wrote that. He probably wrote 2 dozen people that day. But, you know, it was very nice. It was very sweet in its own way. And that's who he became to me. You know, he became a friend.
We're speaking with Michael Schumacher, and the occasion of this particular conversation is a publication very recently of a volume that Michael Schumacher edited titled Allen Ginsberg, South American Journals, January to July of 1960, which is a really interesting point in Allen Ginsberg's life, and these journals are fascinating. But before we get to those journals, for the sake of somebody listening who doesn't really even know who Allen Ginsberg was and why he was so incredibly important, in terms of sort of helping to tip America into a kind of a new modern era of sorts. Describe, as far as you're concerned, what made him such a significant writer and poet and philosopher.
Well, he was all of those things. When I did Dharma Line, it was divided into three parts: poet, prophet, teacher.
Ah.
And he was all of those. And by prophet, I'm not talking about a soothsayer or something. I'm talking about a witness. Somebody who witnesses something and is able to speak, write, whatever, sing.
Put it into words
in a way that is going to be meaningful in the future. And he was all of those things. He made his reputation early when he wrote the poem Howl. And it was subjected to a trial, an obscenity trial. He wasn't even in the country when the trial was on. But the decision that was reached that it was not obscene, and the way the judge presented it, is still being used to this day.
Wow.
It was groundbreaking, and it's still being used to this day in obscenity trials. And he wrote a lot of really, really good poetry early. He was considered very similar, offspring or whatever, of Walt Whitman, the way he wrote.
And he loved Walt Whitman.
Yes, he did, as do I. it was an easy part of dealing with Alan when you like Whitman. And that, he was the first poet that ever spoke to me, Whitman. Alan was the second, maybe. I went to a parochial high school in Milwaukee, and one day one of the nuns said something disparaging fashion about Alan. You shouldn't be reading this. Da, 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 da. So, of course, me being me, I, the first thing I did when I got out of school was went downtown Milwaukee and picked up a copy of Howl. And I read it. I had no idea then what he was talking about. All I know is, boy, does this sound good.
In what I've read about Allen Ginsberg and his poetry, it sounds like one of the things that made him and some who were part of that sort of beat generation of writers and poets, what set them aside was the way that they used real life and their own experiences in their poetry. And I was kind of surprised to read that, because in some ways it sort of feels like, hasn't that always been what poets did? But apparently not. Or apparently poetry did not tend to be the kind of self-expression it was with somebody like Allen Ginsberg. Can you help us understand what he did that had not been done before?
They got together. It was really, when I say they, there were a number of people, aspiring writers, poets, that met in the mid-1940s at and about the Upper West Side in New York, and more specifically at Columbia University. And a bunch of them started getting into these long discussions about the direction literature was taking. And they came up with what they called, it was their words, the new vision. They were going to write, they were going to make the stuff of reality out of their lives and so forth into work. And Jack Kerouac was one of those people, and he certainly did. His almost his entire production as a novelist was pretty real. Alan's stuff, Alan was still pinned down by the way he had been raised. His father was a published poet, and by what he had been taught in school. So he was writing a lot of rhymed verse and all this stuff, and eventually, you know, he dropped that and started writing this more real. I mean, Howl wasn't ever supposed to be published. He wrote that. He was alone. He was feeling lonely. Everybody was gone. He was going through a particularly rough period of his life. And he sat down one afternoon. I believe it was on a Saturday, but I'm not sure. I have to look that one up. And just put a piece of typing paper in his typewriter, and he just starts. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves down the Negro streets of Dawn, looking for an angry fix. Mm. And it was amazing stuff, you know, and nobody had written. And then when he read it for the first time, that became very historic, because he read it at a certain reading in San Francisco, and it just blew the lid off of everything. Nobody had ever heard anybody that honest. Mm. He was writing about his friends, the best minds of his generation. When you get to know more and more of the biographical background to all of this, it's even more intense. Mm. But even when you don't know, like I said, here I was, about 15 years old or 16 years old or whatever, and I'm reading all this, all I know is it just moved so well. That was something about Alan that always hit me, how well his stuff just moved along. He wrote a wonderful poem that's going to be in the next book called Wichita Vortex Sutra. Hmm. And it was an anti-war poem. Vietnam was going on. He's writing this in 1966. He's going across the country in a Volkswagen camper, and he's writing about what he's seeing, and he gets down to Nebraska. And he's in the heartland, so to speak, in Nebraska and Wichita, Kansas. And everything he's hearing on the radio in the vehicle is war, it seems. And he, I'll make a long story short here, I hope, he decides he's going to do what any American can do. He's going to undeclare the war. And, you know, this is it. I call all the gods, you know, and this and this and this. And he names them all, you know. Mm. And he says, the war is over. But he's also facing in the heartland the horrors of racism. Mm. This was 66. I mean, you're talking about the two big bills that passed LBJ was able to get through for black voting rights and so forth. And there's a little section of Wichita where all the blacks lived, and it was known, not affectionately, as Nigger Town. Mm. And Alan's going through it all, and he's speaking into a tape recorder, and he says, and this is what I mean about the way, the profound, I think. He says, the war's over now, except for the souls held prisoner in Niggertown, still pining for love of your tender white bodies, O children of Wichita. And that's just now stands a hairs up on my neck. You know, because he just, and it's just natural for him. Mm. You know, this is the thing that I always found so unbelievable about some of these poets and writers from that group, was they felt privileged to be able to say whatever they wanted. Mm. It's certainly this case with his journals, as you know. I mean, Alan's all over the map in this book. You know, he's down in South America. And incidentally, I should mention as an aside, he told me personally he was hoping those journals would be published someday. Mm. So I know he really liked them because they were different.
Right.
You were getting into the raw materials, the real, real, stripped bare emotionally, Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, nothing cultured, or the rough edges aren't filed off or filed away. Yeah, it's absolutely all there. Before we talk about the journals, and specifically these journals, I want to ask you about just one facet of his life, but the fact that he came to prominence when he did makes me wonder about the whole matter of him being gay.
Well, it was a big issue for him.
And of course, you know, he really comes to enormous prominence in the 1950s, and it's a completely different thing then versus what it is now to be gay in America.
Oh, it wouldn't have been anything now, really.
Right.
That he was gay.
Scarcely worth mentioning, but very much a different kind of issue then. So what is your sense of how he lived with that, how he handled that, how secretive was he about that?
He was everything about it. You know, when he was a high school kid, for example, he had crushes like anybody does, and being homosexual, it was guys. And he was very, very quiet about it. He didn't dare. And he eventually met Neil Cassady, who is the main character in Kerouac's book On the Road. He was Dean Moriarty. And Cassady was like a sexual, I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. He was basically straight, but he went the other way once in a while, and he did with Alan. And that was the first time Alan had any kind of a meaningful relationship with anyone. And then he started to come out a little bit more and a little bit more. He had gone when he moved to San Francisco in 1953. He'd gone to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist encouraged him to do what he wanted to do with his life. You know, Alan always, he worked in market analysis. He did all this stuff. But he wanted to be a poet. And the psychologist says, why don't you? Well, he also said this about Alan's gay aspects. Follow your heart. You know, you can't pretend to be what you're not. And so he did. And it's really funny because it all came full circle. One day I was giving him a hard time. We were out and about, and he was checking out this young guy, you know, college kid. And I said, well, geez, Alan, you're just a dirty old man. And he says, what? He says, this is what I liked when I was younger. What, do you think my taste changed? And I set up a very funny kind of conversation. But he was always open about it as an adult, and he became a spokesperson for him. And it did create issues. I remember being out with him in Boulder, Colorado. They were devoting 8 days to an Allen Ginsberg festival. They gave him the keys to the city, all this other stuff. And Allen, decisively gay, and his publisher and friend, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, very not gay, gave a conference, a press conference, where they talked about NAMBLA, North American Man-Boy Love Association, which is a very, extremely controversial group, because people think this is, you know, a bunch of people preying on young boys or this or that, which is not the case. It is sometimes, you know, it depends on who the person is, the individual is. But they wanted to support NAMBLA, and were using this occasion to do it in support as a First Amendment issue. Alan thought that if you are able to discuss anything, it diffuses some of the explosive nature of what you're discussing. And so I remember his office manager, a guy named Bob Rosenthal, and I, we were both straight, and then on top of everything else, we both had teenage boys at the time. And the discussion we had with Alan and Ferlinghetti, because my take was, look, I don't disagree with you on anything that you're saying here, but you realize, of course, you cannot win this argument. You can't. And you're going to get crucified for this. And he took his chances. I always thought that was one thing about Alan that people never really understood was how his courage. He really did. He had courage. He would step into the most insane situations and discuss, or he would defuse things. One of my favorite Alan stories, he and Peter Orlovsky, his lifetime partner, walking down the streets in the East Village of New York, and they're coming up on a group that is assembled, and it's very loud and it's very angry. Apparently, there were two homeless people who had once been married, or they were once an item, whatever. And she's seen him, and she's attacking him verbally, and she has a dog that's snarling at him, and it's just a really bad scene. And, you know, people are excited to gather and all this stuff. Alan walks into the bodega there, with the little grocery store, and he just disappears. He comes out with a bag, and there are all these people standing around still fighting, and it's just really bad. He reaches into the bag, and he pulls out a cookie. He says, Fig Newton, anyone? And that defused the entire situation. It just calmed down. These are the kinds of things that's very hard to, I mean, we could talk for 10 hours. I can tell you these really strange stories because he just followed instinct so much. And instinctively, he was generally pretty good.
Yeah. And it sounds like that was a big part of who he was, that we should not suppress our instincts. We should follow, our instincts are there for a reason, and his instincts led him into some crazy experiences.
You could go on and on. You know, the sexual liberation thing, or gay liberation, was like one. I mean, you could look at how he was anti-war,
right?
How he was, you know, with drugs. I mean, he testified in front of the Senate. You know, because he was considered one of the foremost authorities. He had a large collection that still exists of drug articles and everything you can possibly imagine. I mean, you go on and on. I mean, this guy had an interest in everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'd be a little silly or foolish or whatever, but a lot of times he wouldn't be.
Mm. Let's talk for a moment about all the traveling he did. And these particular journals that are from this latest book are his South American journals, mm-hmm. from written in Chile and other places.
Yes.
But first, briefly, just give us a sense of how much he traveled and why he traveled so much and how that was an important part of his life and who he was.
He was probably the most curious person I've ever known. Hmm. He was always wanting to learn. When he was around and he was going to be in Chicago promoting a book or something, I would go down there and I would drive him around from appointment to appointment, you know, radio interviews, whatever. And he was always asking, okay, what's going on here? What is happening? How does Chicago deal with this or that? He wanted to know. And travel sprung out of all of that. He was in his 20s. Before he'd ever traveled at all to speak of out of this country. But when he did, his first major one was he went to Mexico, and he lived down there. And Alan was always smart enough or capable enough, or both, to stay a long time. Hmm. In other words, you go to Mexico, you stay 6 months. And he was in Yucatan, you know, and he was exploring the Mayan ruins and everything. This was just him. Then he'd write about it. He'd draw pictures. Excuse me, in his notebooks. This was, he endlessly curious, and he would want to know, you know, where, no matter where he was, he'd want to know what is going on here. And he would write about it. He would study it himself. He would make a nuisance out of himself sometimes, inquiring other people about what was going on. He'd definitely make a nuisance out of himself if he was interested in something that country wasn't. Now, this was an interesting book in respect to, this was the first time he'd been in South America. And his friend William Burroughs, another giant of a writer, had gone down there a few years earlier in pursuit of ayahuasca, or short, known as Yahe for short. And it was the most powerful hallucinogen natural in that's known and still is. And he found Burroughs, found somebody would administer it to him, and he wrote a series of letters to Alan that were pretty wild. And Alan decided he wanted to try this. He had been asked to judge a poetry contest once again down in Chile. And he went down there, and it was a real good period for him. And when he was all done, he moved up. He stayed briefly in Bolivia, and then he moved into Peru, where this was it. But this was also, see, it wasn't just drugs. You know, he tried the ayahuasca, I believe it was 6 times. But he found a medicine man type thing who would administer it. It was very carefully taken care of. But he was also seeing going up to Machu Picchu.
Before it was a big tourist destination.
Exactly.
Yes.
Alan in Mexico hung a hammock up in the main building at Chichen Itza, and he slept there. He hung out, and it wasn't a big thing there. He did the same in Machu Picchu. he just hung up a hammock and he slept in one of the buildings there. And it was so provocative to him, all of these different things he was seeing. Only Alan would get really, really excited about a trip up the Amazon where he was getting eaten alive by mosquitoes, you know, and only Alan would write about it.
Right. At what point, this is 1960, mm-hmm. what is the year 1960 in kind of his life and career trajectory? By this point, he's pretty famous, right?
Yes. He's known, but he hasn't broken through as far as the television aspect is mm-hmm. concerned. That happened probably around 65. But he was well known, and there, people were writing about him and so forth. This was an important, I always thought this was an important book as a connecting point. He was very big into the poetry of William Blake, and that's not unusual. Jim Morrison of the Doors was big. Chris Christopherson, the country artist, was big. You know, Michael McClure, the poet. They all had a strong, powerful connection to William Blake, who was a prophetic voice, you know, in poetry back in England in the 19th century. And Alan actually had what he thought were visions of William Blake. And he was tied up and hung up on this idea. And in 1962 and 3, he traveled to India and elsewhere in the Far East. But India, he lived there for over a year. And he was consulting with these holy men and this and that. What about the Blake visions? Now, this book is a connecting point. He was just then. Now, you have to remember a time when drugs were considered pretty radical. Hmm. You know, Timothy Leary was just discovering in 1960, you know, psilocybin and LSD and so forth. And Alan, he was using Alan as a guinea pig sometimes. Alan was a guinea pig at the Stanford University LSD studies. Hmm. You know, he would go in there and he wrote poetry under different drugs, influences. He kept very careful charts. I took this drug, how long did it work, this and this and this, and here's some poetry.
So he wanted to know how these various substances were affecting him creatively.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Or consciousness, that was one of his favorite sayings, was the message is widen the area of consciousness.
Hmm. And this was one way to do that.
This was one way to do it.
As far as he was concerned. So tell us, first of all, what the purpose of these journals was as far as Allen Ginsberg was concerned. How was he treating them, or what role did they play in his life, do you think?
Well, he kept them, as did Kerouac. Kerouac's journals are amazing, you know, but they're in prose, a lot of them. And as you saw from this book, there's a lot of prose, but there's also a lot of poetry. Alan, it was the raw materials for what he might use. Hmm. People thought Alan published everything he wrote. Well, as it's clear in these journals, that isn't the case at all. He would use certain things as touching off or launching pads, so to speak, for poetry. He wanted to get inside his powers of observation, perhaps. It's hard to say, but he wanted to put it all down on paper, and then he would go back. Sometimes what he put down was good enough, and sometimes it was just this launching point for something. And certainly here, from that period that he went down to South America, he only published a handful of poems from that six-month period, but he also wrote hundreds of pages of journals. So, you know, sometimes you'd use it and sometimes you wouldn't. He wrote a wonderful poem, a very strange, called Magic Psalm. You know, he wrote these poems. Magic Psalm was about an experience, you know, under drugs. He wrote a poem called Laughing Gas. He had a cousin who was a dentist, and he'd have his cousin put him just to the point of passing out. laughing gas because he wanted to understand death if he could. Hmm. And ayahuasca took him to places he would have preferred not to explore. You know, I always thought that was weird about, and Alan and I talked about it, like LSD. You know, it's interesting what it does in terms of opening your mind to something or your mind to yourself, but sometimes it might take you to places you probably would have been better off not visiting.
Right.
You know, and Alan, again, he had a horrible, his first trip on ayahuasca was terrifying, but he went back for a second and a third because that's just who he was.
That's probably getting back to that sense of curiosity that
you're
telling us about. Yes. Among the memorable passages in these South American journals is a long, extended description of when, I believe for the first time, he meets Marlon Brando, the great actor.
When Howl was released, the poem, in book form, with a couple of other poems as well, he sent a copy to Brando. And Alan was not, Alan didn't take rejection well. But Brando never commented on it or anything like that. But Alan saw Brando, first of all, as a gay man, he had no issues with the way Brando looked back in those days, that's for sure. But he he thought Brando sort of was, it's hard to say, he was like the personification of the beat way of doing things. Mm. I know Kerouac wanted really for Brando to star in a motion picture that he wanted to write, you know, about the Beat Generation. Because Brando, he was obviously extremely intelligent. And he certainly wasn't afraid to speak his mind. And he was very, very good at what he did. And this was, and Alan, I should say, you know, not just with Brando, but with others, he was kind of like a groupie. You know, he liked meeting these people. I mean, he met the Beatles. You know, he was just taken by it, you know. And it was that way all the way through. If he liked people, and the thing was, is people liked Alan, you know. So it was interesting to see his writing on meeting these people because – he could be sort of like a groupie, you know, his writing about meeting the Beatles or Dylan was an exception. They just took, they knew each other's work. And when he met Bob Dylan, it just took off, period. But a lot of the people that were famous and, you know, it's funny because to give you an idea, and this also might illustrate a little bit about Alan too, is I was out in New York when I was working on Dharma Lion. I spent the summer of 1988 out there, in fact, the entire summer. And every day, because of where I was staying on the Upper West Side, I would go to Strawberry Fields, which is the John Lennon Memorial in the park, in Central Park, right across the street from the Dakota, where Alan was killed.
Right, right.
And it's a beautiful, very quiet place, very, very nice. Mm-hmm. And I would go there, and I'd take my notebook with me, and I'd sit down and, you know, I'd work. And when I went out to New York, the very first time I was there, I said, now, what do you do? I was standing in a bookstore, and here's Sam Shepard and Jessica Lange, no more than 6 feet away from me. You know, I'm like, whoa, well, this is different.
Yeah.
You know, and they were in the bookstore. And so I asked my editor, what do you do about something like that? He said, oh, no, people expect that. Just go up to them, say what's on your mind, and make it brief, and it's fine. Don't ask them out to lunch or something. But just
right.
That kind of thing. He said, except Yoko Ono. You do not ever approach Yoko. Now, I don't know who in their right mind would have. She used to go jogging every day in a park with two guys right about the size of a, you know, I mean, huge, you know, and she'd jog. And I saw her every day in a park. You know, I'd be sitting there working. I'd see her go jogging by. And it was really funny. One day I was sitting there working. I was writing. I had my head down. All of a sudden I hear this, would you mind if I ask what you're doing? I looked up. It was Yoko.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, I was pretty amazed, you know. And she said, I said, I'm working on this book. It's a biography of Allen Ginsberg. And she goes, oh, Allen. Because Allen had been very, very instrumental in keeping her and John Lennon in this country. They were trying to kick him out, and he had led a charge that was instrumental in their staying.
Wow.
And, you know, it's really funny because there was never again another moment. We saw each other every day. Never again. But she her curiosity, and I love people that are curious.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Hey, she had something in common with Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah,
in that way.
And just try, but the way, you know, just that's how people reacted to him. Oh, Allen.
Wow.
And so here with these books, you know, the journals, you're getting a chance to really see him.
Right.
You know, he didn't ever intend to publish them. You know, that just came later, but you're seeing him, whatever is moving him at the moment, whatever he's noticing. One of my favorite Allen statements, notice what you notice. We all notice things. But did you notice that you noticed it?
Right, right.
And it's kind of a weird sort of thing,
yeah,
you know?
Like let it really penetrate.
Yes, and that's what these books are.
Yeah.
He's noticing what he's noticed.
Absolutely. I agree. I want to be sure to give you, we just have a couple minutes left, but I want you to just say a word about what it was like to edit these journals. And, of course, part of it is you don't want to edit away
yes.
the raw quality that makes them so compelling. But just describe to our listeners a couple of the sorts of decisions that you would have to make in terms of in what way to
some
edit
of them
these
are
journals.
Very easy. I mean, in terms of decisions, Allen was a bad speller, for example. You know, he probably would have disagreed with me on that, but he was a pretty bad speller. And do you change that? The academics was a no, you don't. I had to make decisions on that. I would not ever have him misspelling something that would have embarrassed him if it had been published. Or it probably would have been noticed anyway, but, you know, that was. But there were other things, you know, is this, like with this book about the South American journals, I left some of the stuff just became very repetitive. You know, so you save the nuggets, the best stuff, and the rest you excise from the manuscript. And so I felt a real strong obligation to Allen, as you can imagine. But what was interesting was one time I was in San Jose, and this was right after Dharma Lion came out, and Allen was working on another book of his journals with another guy, a guy named Gordon Ball, who's a friend of mine. And Gordon and Allen was he was tough. We laugh. That's the common joke now. It's been so easy to publish Allen books now that he's gone, you know, because he was really a hard character. And I kept that in mind. But I also watched him working with Gordon, how he dealt with the stuff when he was alive to say. And I tried to keep all that in mind. In fact, Gordon has been a big source, you know, of help throughout all this, because I would ask him about, what do you think Allen would think about this or this? And that's what it's not easy, but it's not the worst thing either. I mean, it's good work if you can get it.
You've got it. It really is it's a fascinating book, and for anybody who is interested in who Allen Ginsberg was, you're right. It's like we're tapping right into his soul. I want to give you a quick chance to just list off for us the other books by Allen Ginsberg that you have written, and the biggie that is on the horizon.
Yeah, well, my book that I wrote, Dharma Lion, is a straightforward biography. I also edited, and this was a funny experience. I hope it won't take long. I edited a book of letters that he exchanged with his father over the course of their life. It was called Family Business, which is what they used to joke about. Now, poetry's a family business because Allen's brother wrote poetry too. And when I first wanted to do it, Allen couldn't see it. What's that all about? You know, and his office guy, Bob Rosenthal, what's that all about? I said, no, if you want to understand Allen, everybody remembers Allen and his mother because his mother was you know, she's a paranoid schizophrenic, spent a lot of her life in a home. His father was the published poet. His father was the one he exchanged notes with on politics, because Kerouac or Burroughs, neither one of them were interested at all in politics. Hmm. And so that book, and that became one of the Ginsberg camp's favorite books, because it just, and again, it was just my editing here. And then there was a book of a greatest hits sort of thing called the Ginsberg, the Essential Ginsberg, which came out, which is the best of his poetry, his prose, his interviews, his journal entries, almost anything you can imagine, even his photos. Then I did a book of interviews that he had given, a lot of times with very small, long out of print publications. These little things that sprung up in his 60s, you know, and 70s. And then these three books of journals, one, the Iron Curtain journals, about when he went and had all kinds of adventures overseas. Then this book, South American journals. And the last book is called The Fall of America Journals. He wrote a book called The Fall of America, a book of poems, very large by his standards even. And it won the National Book Award in 1973. Hmm. And it was, you want to know about America in the 1960s? Here's your chance. Hmm. And there's just so much good stuff in there. It's really funny. Hmm. You know, all the, so much classic stuff. The first drafts of some classic poems and such. So people have never seen this before.
Hmm. Wow. He's been a treasure trove for you, hasn't he? You owed a lot to Allen Ginsberg, and he owes a lot to you in what you have done to help share his legacy with the world. Again, this most recent book just published is Allen Ginsberg, South American Journals, January to July of 1960, published by the University of Minnesota Press, and the editor, Michael Schumacher. Michael Schumacher, once again, it's just been a wonderful hour, and the time has just flown by way too quickly.
It always does.
It's always great to talk with you, and when you write another book, I hope you will make time in your busy schedule to join us on the morning show. It's always great to exchange ideas with you and to
hear
what you're up to.
Well, the Fall of America is this fall.
All right.
So you never know.
We'll look forward to it. Thank you so much, Michael Schumacher, for being
here
today. Tomorrow on the morning show for Black History Month, you're going to hear my interview with Isabel Wilkerson, the author of an amazing book called The Warmth of Other Suns, which tells the story that's really largely untold about the massive migration of Southern blacks to other parts of the United States over the course of many decades. It really helped reshape America itself and also really helped reshape the look of America. Really, really important book, and we talk about it tomorrow on the morning show. And on Wednesday, I am excited to take out of the archives from many, many years ago an interview